Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking the musical and cultural impact of Living Color with professor and author Kimberly Mack. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review some new music from Blur and Claude.
I'm fixtures and fittings now. Call me out, but call me. Cause there's something down here and it's living under the floorboards.
That was a little bit of the song St. Charles Square by Blur, as performed, they performed that one at Wembley, Greg. Big reunion gig this year, big reunion album, their ninth in their discography. Who was Blur? Seems absurd, but most of our audience is in America to have to ask that question. Look, in the UK, they were as big as Nirvana. Britpop was rivaling grunge in terms of sales in the 90s, completely overshadowed here in the States. We were a bit xenophobic, I think. And of course, part of the Britpop story was the great feud between Oasis and Blur. Oasis became the bigger band, filling stadiums. Blur was by far the better band, not to tip my hand. Amazing live, amazing growth in the studio over six albums between 91 and 99. Leisure, My Modern Life is Rubbish, right? Park Life. Damon Albarn's gone on to mega success. Solo albums, world beat albums, traveling the globe, and of course, Gorillaz, with all sorts of hip-hop superstars, that wonderful cartoon band. Damon Albarn at 55, my God, I'm feeling old, recently went through the end of his 25-year marriage. He's had his ups and downs in his career. There was a bout with heroin addiction. Now he's a yoga dad, as he self-effacingly calls himself. So what is Albarn reuniting with the original members of Blur, always a fantastic rhythm section, and Graham Coxon, his right-hand man on guitar, a wonderful psychedelic pop mad genius in the Syd Barrett mode, without the troubles. What are these four gents giving us? Let's play a song from the album. It is called The Ballad of Darren, and this is Blur with The Narcissist.
Found my transcendence. It played in mono, painted blue. You were the Pyro. I was the dark room. I'm the shining light in your eyes. You're probably shining back on.
That is The Narcissist from Blur's new album, The Ballad of Darren. Who is Darren? He's Darren Smoggy Evans, Blur's longtime security guard. Yeah. You know, and right away you sort of get the sense that there's kind of a nostalgic glow to this record. You know, we're looking back, taking stock. Where were we? Where are we going? You know, Damon is big on the introspection on this record. You know, Jim, it's a midlife crisis record. You know, they look back with very mixed feelings about where they've been. You know, the tracks we were talking about, St. Charles, I effed up. Every generation has its gilded posers.
Yeah.
including them, apparently, in Damon's view. We've lost the feeling that we thought we'd never lose in Barbaric. You know, it's like, where is that? And you know, youth is great, but man, we went through some stuff, and I'm glad we're out of that, or we think we are. And then, now he's thinking about now in Faraway Island. You know, I know you think I must be lost, but I'm not anywhere. You know, in the Heights, that big grand finale with the guitar Oblivion at the end.
Yeah.
Seeing through the coma in our lives, are we running out of time?
Through the coma in our lives. Some things so bright out there you can't even see it. Are we running out of time?
What struck me is the perspective that Damon Albarn is taking as a lyricist, because I love this guy in Blur, especially the way he was taking stock of where England was, you know, looking outward, commenting on the changing mores of the time, much like Ray Davis, you know, the
Kinks,
right?
I've said that before. He was the sociological observer, non-parallel, right up there with Davis.
And a great storyteller and incredibly detailed songwriting, in addition to incredible melodies. Mm-hmm. And Coxon, the secret weapon in this band, never gets enough love. But man, he's just a genius guitar player, that great rhythm section.
Well, and it must be said, live, Albarn would throw himself physically into the performance every bit as much as Kurt Cobain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, yeah, great band. And, I you know, the Magic Whip record that came out in, what, 2015 now? It's been a while.
Yeah, 2015.
But there was a big break there between albums. Like, I thought they were done. And I loved Gorillaz. I thought, you know, Albarn should stick with that. That was a surprisingly good record. A really, you know, a song like Go Out, I'm waiting for something that good on this record, and I'm not hearing it. This record is a little drab for me.
It is.
It's a little too interior,
A
little sad,
A
little melancholy. They don't do interior confessional melancholy that well, you know?
No.
Kind of a letdown.
I had it on repeat. I try to really live with something as complicated as a Blur album. And, you know, I also realized that while I didn't dislike Magic Whip in 2015, I've also never gone back to it.
Right.
Not the way I've gone back to Modern Life is Rubbish or The Great Escape or 13 when they discovered America indie rock, right? Mm-hmm. And up top, Damon announces, "I just looked into my life and all I saw was that you're not coming back. Oh, can't you see when the ballad comes for you, it comes like me." All right, Damon.
Yeah, right.
I just look to my life and all I saw was that you're not coming back. Oh, can't you see when the ballad comes for you?
They have given us lush, sweeping ballads in the past, usually as one or two tracks on an album that was much more complicated and much more diverse. The ballads drag everything down here. I do love St. Charles Square. I think it's a great, noisy pop song. There's a couple of other good pop songs. The Narcissist was one of them, and Goodbye, Albert. But man, they are stuck in one groove. And look, 55... Yeah. Says the 59-year-old rock critic, well, soon to be 59. You know, that is not that old, Damon. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Come on, get off it. Your life is good if you're Damon Albarn, right? You got all these friends with Gorillaz. You travel the world. You make music. Your old mates are still your mates. Let's see Oasis try to make a reunion album. Ain't going to happen, right? one of the most important bands I've covered in my professional career, and this is not an album up to their best.
Yeah, bring back Gorillaz. That's a bit of a song called A Good Thing from the new Claude album on Sound Opinions. The new Claude album is called Supermodels. Who is Claude? One Claude Mintz, Highland Park-born singer-songwriter. Highland Park, where is that? About 25 miles outside of Chicago. They keep calling it a Chicago suburb in some of the pieces I've been reading. I'm not so sure if it's a suburb. It's a 30,000... population it's town.
You know, well, and now but, sadly known for the shootings there last July 4th.
Indeed. Anyway, Claude went to college, dropped out to pursue music, living in Brooklyn now. Non-binary, uses they, them pronouns, Claude does. They're known for songs like Soft Spot and Wish You Were Gay. These are the kind of songs that resonated with a young audience. You know who liked them?
Phoebe Bridgers.
Phoebe Bridgers really liked them. And signed Claude to her label, Satisfactory Records. Debut Claude record came out in 2021, Super Monsters, with that song Soft Spot that I mentioned. And then now on a bunch of tours, Claude has opened for Boy Genius, Paramore, Bleachers, Le Tigre, now headlining a tour in the fall in North America.
Yeah.
So things are happening fast for Claude. We're going to review the second album here in a second. Let's play a track from it. It's called Moving On from Claude on Sound Opinion.
Can you teach me something about moving on? Know how to be in love, but it's the moving on. Is there someone you grasp, another insomniac? I know I'm probably wrong, but I think you're moving.
That was Moving On from Claude's second album, Supermodel. Greg, this album really puts me in a particular time and place. I think it's a gorgeous record. It's a wonderful pop record. It's a great singer-songwriter and producer album, okay? People talk about bedroom pop, but I think Claude's vision in terms of subtle production tricks and tips and you know, just making the songs dense but wonderful, not overly gimmicked up. You know, little vocal chants in the background, repeated noises, a little squiggle of an analog synth that comes and goes. This is a wonderful tapestry. I wish my bedroom had that many instruments in it and I could use them that well. But, you know, it is about the singer-songwriter. You know, a great way with hooks, a great way with observations. We were making fun of Damon Albarn at the ripe old age of 55, kind of talking like an old man and being wistful and looking back. You know, in my head, I'm forever 22, that awkward age where you're out of your teens. Thank God. Those were difficult. But mm-hmm. you're trying to figure out what is a real relationship. Right. Am I in one? Could this be one now? Am I adult enough to have one? Do I deserve one? Right? These are the things Claude is talking about as they examine themselves and look at their life. The little things are adding up. The little crumbs I hate cleaning up.
I can feel the little things adding up. The little crumbs I hate cleaning up. But I will for you, I will for you, whatever you want.
I think that's a particular time that we often get the teenage angst albums, and then we get the middle-aged albums, right?
Yeah.
You know, but it's that 22, when you were 22. This is what the album is about, and I think it's a beautiful record that really moved me the more I kept listening to it.
Yeah, my initial reaction was kind of, it's okay.
Mm.
And it really did sort of, you know, seep in, and I realized there was a lot more going on here than I first realized. As you said, the little things are adding up. That's a key line. That's the first song. I think there's a reason that's the first song on the record. It's very quiet, very contemplative, very much in that bedroom pop mode where it's just a singer with guitar performing a song. But then the album slowly expands, and as you mentioned, the detail in the production is revelatory. It's quiet, but at the same time, it's really cool. You know, it's a basic format, pop song structures.
Well, verse, when they
verse
perform,
choruses, you know, pre-choruses.
And bridges. When they perform live, it's a simple trio.
Right. You know, it's a bigger bedroom, Jim. You know,
that's all I can tell you.
It's a bigger bedroom. It must be an apartment or whatever. I didn't get any detail on where exactly this record was recorded. But, you know, these little, I just made little notes on these cool little production touches. That song, Every Effing Time. That strummed guitar, that bedroom voice, those little echoed backing vocals in there really got to me.
'Cause I can't believe it when you say you love me. I just can't believe it. 'Cause with you there's always something.
In Wet, that I love that groove. I love that drum beat and bass, that sparser groove, that moody vocal, and that the washes of synthesizer in there, you know? So there's some electropop going on here. It's not just a little acoustic-y record. It's there's more things. Those little hand claps in that song. Glass Wall, that tortured guitar distortion in the middle of that song.
Just a little taste of it.
It's not overdone. It is about small moments and the accumulation of those small moments in a series of relationships. And you know, it's really well done for what it is. A very promising second record from Claude.
Well, and we've talked about a couple of striking vocalists in recent shows with an androgynous voice. And I think in the same way that Boy Genius talks to boys, girls, and people who are questioning their gender identity, they talk to everybody. You know, I think Claude's doing the same thing. I can see why Phoebe is a fan.
Absolutely. So that's what we thought of the new music from Blur and Claude, and now we want to hear from you, our listeners. Leave us a voice message with your thoughts on our website at soundopinions.org. When we return, a conversation on the band Living Color on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. This week, we're talking about a band that we've neglected to get to for entirely too long, Living Color. We're both longtime fans, and it's about time, Greg, that we do a deep dive.
Absolutely, Jim. Today, we're going to be talking with Kimberly Mack, an associate professor of English at the University of Illinois, who wrote a book on Living Color called Time's Up. Kimberly, what a pleasure it is to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I love the way this book on Living Color opens. You put us right in the scene. You are at a show by Living Color. You, the young Kimberly Mack, is in the middle of a mosh pit. Losing your mind to Living Color. And that sort of begins this book. You go into depth because that's the tour that Time's Up had been released around, right? The second Living Color album, the follow-up to the big hit album with Cult of Personality on it, right? But I think you hit it, you nailed it. Time's Up, the 1990 album, is the one. It is a masterpiece. Mm. It's still the best album, one of the best albums of that decade. What was that like for you as a young rock fan to be in that audience as Living Color was starting to play those songs live?
Yeah, it was quite an experience, and also it was quite a learning experience. You know, I was somebody who grew up with a mom who indulged my love of rock and took me to rock concerts. And, you know, I went to my first one when I was 11. But they were very different kinds of shows. They were theater shows or arena shows. I had never, well, maybe one time I think I'd been to a club show, but it was, I believe it was the Waterboys. So it was a little different. So so going to hear Living Color play at a little club and having a mosh pit there and having that kind of thing happen was completely new for me. And I didn't really know what to expect. You know, I was into rock. I was into even some harder rock, like, you know, Van Halen and Zeppelin and some other bands. But I just hadn't been to a show where that kind of physical aggression might happen. And this actually got cut out of the book. But when I first got there, I was there with my roommate and very good friend, and also someone I'd just started dating a few months earlier. My boyfriend asked me, asked both of us, where do you want to stand? You know, like, where do you want to be? And we both said, we want to be in the front. Like, of course, let's just go to the front. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget this because he kind of looked at us really quizzically, like he couldn't believe it. He was kind of surprised and a little impressed, but I was like, yeah. And he's like, are you sure? Yes, up front. So we went up front and, you know, the first song in, everything was chaos and the floor, you know, the whole floor just opened up and a mosh pit broke out. And I lasted, I don't know, seconds before I was on my ass, so.
Well, Kim, you've said of that show that it made you feel less alone in your rock fandom as a black girl. And we have to remember that. You know, a lot of rock at that point was exclusionary to black fans, especially black girls.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. That's why this book is personal. It's personal because this is the band that really made quite an impact on my musical development and also just my political consciousness and a lot of things, but just their presence meant a whole lot. And I liked Vivid, I owned Vivid, I loved Cult of Personality. Of course, that song was just everywhere. I saw them on Showtime at the Apollo. I remember watching that with my mom, and we were both really just so enamored with these four young men who were just doing their thing, and they just sounded so great. And yeah, it meant a lot to me that they looked like me. And, you know, and then Time's Up was a whole other thing where when I first heard the record, it really spoke to me from a kind of like an aggression and angry level and passionate level. And then going to the show and having that live experience and seeing them up there, it did make me feel like, okay, maybe I do belong in this world where I wasn't quite sure I did belong for much of my childhood.
Well, it was an important era, you know, this idea, the Black Rock Coalition, the Vernon Reid, the guitar player in Living Color, was a huge part of that. And sort of the idea of it's black music. It started out, you know, what about Fats Domino? What about Chuck Berry? What about Little Richard? They invented this stuff. And suddenly, as you write, rock became conflated with whiteness. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like here are black rockers reclaiming that in a sense. Was that sort of macro view part of your experience at that point, or was that something that you kind of came to realize as you were turning into adulthood?
When I was a child, I didn't question the whiteness of rock at all. I just took that for granted. I thought that it was white. And, you know, and my mom, in addition to playing rock music in our house, she also collected rock magazines and, you know, was a reader of rock magazines. So even when I was looking at Rolling Stone or Cream or Trouser Press or Relics or any of those magazines, many of the people in them were also white. I mean, there were some black artists in there as well from time to time, but I also assumed that all the writers were white. You know, I just that whole, the whole world seemed to be that, and I didn't question it. It was alienating for sure, but I didn't question it. But when I saw Living Color and I saw what they were doing, I saw who they were, I saw what they were about, it really did make a difference, you know? And that's when I started to really question it. And that's when I was just like, oh, wait a minute. This really truly is my music, my cultural inheritance as well. And I felt confident at that point to begin to claim it. It still took me a little bit, but yeah, that band was really important, and particularly that song Pride with the lyrics, you know, don't ask me why I play this music, because it's my culture, so naturally I use it. Those words were everything to me.
Tell us where the band was at, Kimberly, when they set out to make Time's Up. They'd had this huge commercial breakthrough. You know, what did they feel they had to prove? What did they hope they wanted to accomplish?
Yeah, they had such spectacular success with that first record, you know, critically, commercially, very, very unquestionably successful record. They definitely didn't want to repeat that record. They wanted to do something different. They wanted to say more. You know, I think they were a band that was always viewed as a bit of a message band. Obviously, they were deeply invested in social justice issues. They spoke very well and were the right band to talk about a lot of those issues. But I think they also wanted to expand the palette and talk about more things on the second record lyrically, in addition to talking about racism and classism and police brutality and gentrification. They also talked about love and death and grief. You know, Solace of You was about Corey's dad's passing, which happened right before they kind of blew up. When it hurts to be out there, where no one cares, I've got the solace of you. And they also were talking about things like the internet, which, you know, wasn't there yet, but, you know, they were kind of predicting the chaos and the with information overload. You know, so they wanted to just expand their palette lyrically. And they also, sonically, were just doing, I think, really bold experimental moves with all of these different styles of music that they were, engaging, but also in within one song. You know, they would sometimes move between these different styles. You know, I think they just wanted to stretch out and show that they were more than kind of the funk rock band, you know, that box that they kind of put in to. You know, Greg Tate, I had a chance to interview Greg Tate for this book, and the way he put it was he felt like it was because of their blackness, this sense of not being able to kind of rest on your laurels and always having to be twice as good, that kind of thing. So, you know, no half-stepping on this record. But I do think they felt an internal pressure to not have this be more of the same, but to have it be something different, something bolder. And they achieved that for sure.
We talked about this before, Kim, but I thought the band was just an extraordinary group of musicians, you know, just so the backgrounds of each of these instrumentalists was incredible. Mm-hmm. Vernon Reid was coming out of a free jazz kind of scene, and Calhoun and Skillings, you know, jazz and funk and blues backgrounds. I mean, these guys were musically so wide open to stuff. How hard was it for them to work in more of a commercial medium like rock? You know, I think of the first record as sort of tentative in some ways, as good as it was, Vivid, and Cult of Personality. It was a little bit boilerplate-ish in terms of it was kind of an understandable hard rock record, right? And I think the second one, what was so amazing about that was just how wide open it was, the scope of the record musically. So what was your sense? You interviewed all the band members.
Yes.
And their producer. What was the thinking about that? Like, oh, are people going to even understand this?
Yeah, so, you know, the mindset was, again, you know, not repeating what they already did and doing something different. But also, you know, I had some really interesting conversations with Muzz Skillings, who is the former bass player. And he talked about genre. We talked about genre with Vernon a little bit too. And he talked about how he kind of felt like the band, because they were a black rock band in the late 80s, in early 90s, people would talk about their eclecticism, you know, talk about their movement between these different styles of music in ways that would undermine their rock legitimacy, you know. So they would refer to them as funk rock or funky rock, stuff like that. And he felt like it was always, you know, kind of like subtle digs at their authenticity as rockers. And the way that he put it, which I think is great, when they were moving between all these different styles, and, you know, particularly on this record, they were not trying to create a fusion or a dilution. They were expanding the category of rock. They were adhering to all of the, you know, the conventions of rock at that time, you know, and they were very aware of it. But they were not trying to, again, create some sort of a fusion. They were just, showing all of the ways that all these different sounds and styles are still rock. In part because of their blackness, they were probably punished a bit for doing that. You know, I think white rock artists were, you know, have historically been allowed to be really promiscuous, you know, with different genres and moving between these different styles, and no one questions whether it's rock or not, you know, the whole like rock ballad kind of thing. I mean, nobody questioned any of that, you know.
Tell us about the Black Rock Coalition and what that meant. I think, you know, I was growing up in New York at that point. I didn't leave until 91, or I remember reading about it in the Village Voice, right? And a decade earlier, the great punk rock critic Lester Bangs had written a piece that's often cited still to this day, The White Noise Supremacists, standing at CBGB, looking around and saying, here is a musical movement that welcomes all sorts of outsiders, you know, LGBTQ, a big, tall, gangly Jewish guy who becomes a rock star. You don't have to be Robert Plant, you can be Joey Ramone. And yet there were no black faces, except for Ivan Julian. And that piece gets revisited and updated, you know, through the years by Pitchfork writers and other writers, you know. But it's still sort of a problem in rock. It seemed as if the Black Rock Coalition was finally changing that. Did they succeed? You know, did they do what Vernon hoped they would do?
That's a great question. All you have to do is kind of go on YouTube and see those reaction videos where you've got, you know, this whole weirdness around black people listening and engaging with rock right now. And the way in which it's framed as if it's such a shocking, novel thing. And then in the comments, you'll have all these people who are just like, oh, I'm so happy that you're listening to different kinds of music. And it's so weird. What I will say is I think there are more young black people, young black kids who are engaging with punk and engaging with hardcore and engaging with rock in different ways now than probably before, like young people. But I don't think that it's any less shocking or any less perceived as weird or different now than then. And I don't remember if we talked about this. I'm not sure we did, Greg, but I think it's interesting because right now we're having some really good conversations about reclamation and music and popular music. And of course, that's happening a lot in country music. And there's been a very public and I think effective like campaign around that. But we're not really having that with rock. And I think part of it is probably because rock isn't as prominent. The status is not the same as it was. But I still think that many, many people conflate rock with whiteness. I don't think that has changed all that much.
When we return, more of our conversation about living color. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
And we're back. This week, we're talking with professor and author Kimberly Mack about all things living color, specifically the 1990 album Time's Up. Let's get back to the conversation.
You know, the other thing I was thinking of, too, because we had this discussion as well, Kim, was the whole idea of where blues is gone. You know, there are still black artists making blues records, but the audience is almost entirely white people, right? And the assumption is that for black kids, blues is old news. It's my grandpa's music. You know, I don't need, you know, I've moved on. I'm doing something different now. So
it doesn't speak to me.
Yeah. Rock music, the same thing. I think it became like this white people music because radio stations played white rock artists all the time. And there was bins in the record stores that had rock, but if you happened to have a black face, you were in the funk section. You know, it was just like this automatic separation of people. And it's almost like generations have been trained to think that way by the corporations that control the industry, you know, which is really weird. And I think we're at a time now where people are making playlists and they're mixing and matching genres, so maybe that's breaking down some of the barriers. But I don't know if that'll ever happen, you know? You know, that's my question, I guess, is where do you think it's going? Black people playing rock music that's going to be celebrated in the way Living Color was when they made Cult of Personality.
Yeah. Well, so first, I just want to say that I totally agree with what you just said. I think that, you know, what happened from a corporate perspective, what has historically happened with genres and the ways that genres were created as marketing categories and not having very much to do at all with how the music actually sounded. I think that those narratives Those stories were so effective, and that, yes, those ideas became entrenched. And so here we are. In terms of the future, I think that Living Color, and this is one of the reasons why I, of course, I wrote this book and think that this band is so important. I do think that they, even though it didn't have quite the immediate effect that people hoped, where the floodgates would open and there would just be all these black rock bands coming through and having success and being played on MTV and all this stuff. Even though that didn't happen, I do think that they did open the door for more bands with people of color in the rock bands with people of color in them or black members. You know, of course, Rage Against the Machine and TV on the Radio, Soundgarden, other bands. I do think that they were responsible for that. I think in terms of going forward, as I said, I know that there are young black kids who are playing rock music, you know, and who are playing metal and who are and punk and all these things, or who in these scenes. So I know that that exists. And whether we're going to get to a point where in the mainstream, you know, you see this kind of success that Living Color had, I don't know. That's a hard one, in part because, again, rock music is not really in that position. So there's kind of like two things going on here. There's, you know, rock music is not really in the mainstream right now. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And as I said, even though there are black kids who love this music, and by the way, one thing I want to also say, but I'm also discovering after having written this book that there are people who are my age who... black writers who I've been talking to who are my age who also loved rock and didn't know there was anyone else out there. We've always been there. We just weren't marketed to or paid attention to. These black kids who like rock right now, are they going to be paid attention to? Are they going to be marketed to?
That marketing machine that controlled, anointed some artists and ignored others, I mean, that's gone. Mm-hmm. That's good riddance to it, right? Everything is now available for us to stream and discover at our own pace without the hype. I mean, I'm talking in the middle of a three-night stand, 60,000 people a night by Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
But we can count on one hand those artists that are left, right? So you're a professor. You know, we have an inquisitive young music-loving student, Living Color. Yeah, you know, my parents like them or whatever, right? What would you say to her? Where are you going to steer her? What song to blow her young mind and really turn her on to this band?
It's hard to choose one song, and it also depends on where this young person's head is in terms of what kind of rock they like. Because again, this is a band who played rock in a lot of different registers, you know, like that straight ahead mainstream.
Let's assume they don't like rock at all. You know, they're a hip hop head and they like K-pop.
Okay.
Rock is old white guy music, you know what I mean?
Because
I run into students like this, you know, and then I play them, you know, Veruca Salt or Liz Phair, and they're like, oh, wow. Okay, right.
You know, then I might play a song like Pride because those lyrics are completely relevant right now.
History's a lie that they teach you in school. A fraudulent girl called the golden rule. A peaceful land that was born civilized. Was robbed of its riches, its freedom, its pride.
That chorus, history is a lie that they teach you in school. A fraudulent view called the golden rule. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, let's go to Texas. Yeah.
I mean, I think that would be, you know, especially, you know, being a teacher from that perspective, let's look at the lyrics. Let's talk about how smart and political and important these lyrics are. And then let's listen to the music. I think a song like Pride might pull somebody in right now.
Vernon's guitars, it's undeniable, and that rhythm section just kicks.
But I mean, you know, if the student was a little more adventurous and said, okay, what else? I might steer him to Time's Up, you know, just because I think it packs such a punch, and it's, you know, it just wakes you up and hits you in the head that you never know.
Yeah.
That could be something where like, oh, I didn't know that I liked this music, but okay, here I am now. I was into a lot of rock, some of it harder, some of it not so hard. Some of it, you know, like more new wavy and that kind of thing, Squeeze and Elvis Costello and that kind of stuff. But once I heard Time's Up, it actually pushed me in the direction of harder, heavier music.
I loved about this record, Kim, was that, you know, the mix of the political and social commentary with the more personal stuff. And that song, This Is the Life, I know that has personal meaning for you, but talk about that aspect of it too, because there's a vulnerability in this record in addition to the hard-hitting mm-hmm. stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, that song, I'm so happy, I feel so lucky that I've had the chance to talk to Vernon about that song and try to get a sense of his mindset around some of the ideas in that song then and now. But yeah, I mean, that's a song about accepting the path you're on, accepting the life that you have. Also thinking ahead. I mean, these were young men, you know, and they're thinking at the very beginning of this phase, I'll say, of their careers, you know, and they were thinking about that the inevitability of losing loved ones, of having mm-hmm. things not work out the way you thought they would work out. As Vernon put it in one of the interviews that we did that didn't make it into the book, you know, this is a song that's there when, you know, you're up and then when the grand parade moves on. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, just having that kind of foresight to realize that everything that was happening then was not going to necessarily last forever. And sad things are going to happen and really happy things are going to happen. But whatever it is, it's all your life and you need to find a way to make peace with it.
You had the opportunity to talk to these guys in depth and looking back 25, 30 years on this masterpiece that they made. What do people need to know about Living Color that maybe you didn't think was really that apparent about this record and who they were? What was something that sort of stuck out to you?
Greg, they're all obviously really accomplished artists, musicians, on all of their instruments, including vocals. You know, they're all extremely accomplished. And I think there's maybe sometimes a tendency, I'll just speak for myself here, where when you come across people who are this gifted, you just think that a lot of it comes, that it's natural. You know, there's some level of genius there, and not that they don't work hard, but it's just something that they have that someone else doesn't have. And it was really illuminating to learn about just the amount of work that they all put in. You know, Greg Drew, who was Corey's vocal coach in this time of the band, worked with Corey a lot. And it was really, I had no idea, you know, how hard Corey worked on his voice. And that mm-hmm. was really eye-opening. And just also the little nuances with just certain songs and certain takes and, you know, Corey's willingness to hear that feedback and take it, and his voice, you know, it's extraordinary on this record. And it has mm-hmm. continued to be. His voice right now is fantastic. I don't know if you've heard any of the live stuff recently, but his voice is still great. And that's one of the hardest things to maintain, you know, as you age. But that mm-hmm. level of the care and the attention that he took on his voice was something that I didn't know. And then also, you know, Greg told another story just about Vernon, and this also didn't make it into the book, but it's a kind of a funny story about Greg being in a hotel room, you know, when they were on tour, and being given the room next to Vernon by somebody in the band, and not knowing why he was given in the room, but apparently Vernon would just practice constantly. It was like practicing endlessly.
Yeah. You're not going to yeah. sleep. Yeah.
And that's incredible.
Information overload. I feel like I now have a greater appreciation after reading your book than ever for this album. You know, one of the weird things about covering popular music, the way all three of us do, right, is all of a sudden a really powerful and important and influential artist will come out of the wash. Like, you know, 15 years ago, people discovered Nick Drake, right? Or, you know, there's a Kraftwerk resurgence, yeah. Right? I feel like, man, when's it going to be Vernon and Living Color's turn? It's like we need to come back to this band and give them the appreciation now, and people need to be dropping their name in every interview.
Yes, and that's exactly where I was headed. So here's the thing. One of the things I do in doing the book, as you know, I was grappling with this idea of they're being underrated, because if you look at, go on YouTube and you see something, you know, some video or some live performance, inevitably in the comments, there'll be all these people saying they're so underrated. And I was kind of inclined to think that way too. And realized that actually in their time, not really at all. You know, there were so many people who predicted them as the future of rock. You know, they were compared to Zeppelin and all these kinds of rock acts. And they've lived up to it, even though commercially their career didn't stay at the same level. In terms of the quality of the work that they've done, they have a very nice body of work that is consistently very good. And I think that this is a band who, besides being a really good band with really great records, accomplished musicians who have lyrics that are saying something, that were saying things in 1990 with this record in particular, with Time's Up and talking about the environmental crisis, you know, a hardcore song about the environment that wasn't really a thing at that time. And they've done this over a long period of time. And so I do think that this is a band that people should be talking about. I said this to Vernon. I think they should have all the books, all the documentaries, on top of being groundbreaking and achieving that commercial success that eluded many other black rock bands like Fishbone or others. They have all of this really just quality material. I'm not convinced that, you know, William Duvall, who's, you know, now the lead singer for Alice in Chains, would be that if it hadn't been for Living Color. I mean, Vernon Reid was an early mentor of Williams.
Yeah. And yet we still have Red Hot Chili Peppers as a festival headliner. You know, there's no justice in the world. There's no.
Well, Fishbone's making a new record, so
Fishbone,
you know. Yeah, they're back.
But I think this is a band, and I'll just say it, and I've said it quietly to just people in my personal circles. But I think this band should be in the Rock Hall. I really do, because of, you know, just how good they are musically. I think they should be in the Rock Hall because they did have the requisite commercial success to also support that. And I think they should be in the Rock Hall because of the groundbreaking nature of their existence.
Well said, Kim. I thank you again for filling a huge gap. There's not enough being written about Living Color. I think this might be the first book on Living Color. Certainly one of the first I've read.
Yeah, there's one other book that's out there, and then Marine Man that's focused on Living Color, and then Marine Man did the book Right to Rock about the Black Rock Coalition, so they're in that. But there's not a lot.
There needs to be more, and it's written about one of the timeless records. I hope more people pick it up as a result of your writing. We have been talking with Kimberly Mack, the author of Time's Up, about Living Color, Associate Professor of English at the University of Illinois. Kim, thanks again for joining
us. Thank you.
That wraps up our discussion of Living Color. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, and share your thoughts. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, it's time for another round of buried treasures.
Yeah.
You know, we love doing this show because we're able to feature some deeper cuts, deeper songs of lesser known artists who don't necessarily make it on the mainstream radar, but have made our radar for sure. And we want to know what you think of them as well. So don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.